number 2 and 3 coming your way next. And it is a real pleasure to have back tonight William Bill Tompkins, who is going to share more of his astonishing life experiences, which are coming out in his books. His first book is out now. You can find all that by clicking under his name. But first, let me introduce Major George Filer, who was just on last night, couldn't stay away. Ask if he could come back tonight. Of course you can, George. Welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me.
George would never ask if he could come back. I'm just kidding.
It's going to be an exciting evening with
those
revelations. I've been talking to him for some time, and it's amazing the information that he has and passed on to us.
And what he's been through in his life. It's just astounding, right. Really. And with us also is Frank Chile, who has precipitated and arranged many programs here, and we're deeply indebted to Frank and his friendship and his commitment to the cause. And it's always good to have his voice on with us. Hello, Frank. Welcome.
Good evening, Jeff. Happy New Year to you and your audience.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thanks for arranging this one as well. And let's say hello to Mr. William Tompkins. Hello, Bill. Welcome back.
Well, very good, Jeff. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you folks.
Well, of course. It's our pleasure. You have lived maybe 10 lifetimes already, and you're kind enough to want to share that with us in your books, and you're giving us a preview of just some of the things that you've been involved with, which are nothing less than really extraordinary. And the first book out now, Bill's first book, is called Selected by Extraterrestrials, and it covers his life, his phenomenal earlier life, through the war years and up to his time at TRW, Thompson Ramo Wooldridge, which was a major primary defense contractor like Douglas was, McDonnell Douglas, Missiles and Space, and so many others. And Bill got to experience things and was brought into secrecy circles that are just extraordinary. So we have a lot to talk about. And is there anything you want to say, George Filer, before we start about what we've heard already? There are a lot of people out there who are probably saying, well, I don't know about this. But, you know, you have to take things and process them, and we always ask people to do that in their own way and make their own decisions. They are extraordinary, what we're hearing, the stories, and all I ask is that people open their mind, because anything is possible. George?
Right, I think that's what we have to think about, is that anything is possible. I happened to chase UFOs when I was in the Air Force, but I didn't realize, of course, that some may have been ours. And Bill has more information about that.
But, right, right.
And I do know that our government and these aviation companies are many years ahead of us in science and capabilities that we only can dream about. And that Bill has some of the first inside information about that he's going to bring to us tonight.
Frank, how has this whole story affected you?
Well, I tell you, Jeff, Bill's one of the most remarkable individuals I've ever spoken to, and I have to say this, in all candor, I think not only was he selected by extraterrestrials, but he's been guided and protected by them in his work, in his experiences, and what he's now revealing to us. I mean, it's just,
I had an opportunity to speak
to him in depth, and it's just stunning.
I agree. Okay, young man, and Bill Tompkins is a living memorial to extraordinary talent, great gifts, and great dedication to this country, our heritage, certainly our sciences, and more. So where would you like to start tonight, Bill?
Well, I think it might be advisable that we sort of go back just a little bit and sort of look at how we got into this position that we're in. And so I've mentioned this a little bit before, but I would like to sort of orientate what we're going to be talking about with again, the Navy, and I'm not trying to push the Navy, but because we've got an Air Force guy on there, so I've got to be diplomatic. Okay. For whatever reason, I went in the Navy, and they put me in this in the engineering department of the Naval Air Station in San Diego, and I was assigned as staff to an admiral who was commander of the base, Naval Air Station of San Diego, and this was in 1942. And this is kind of crazy, but this admiral had what some people called as another hobby.
Uh-huh.
And this really wasn't a hobby. He was above naval intelligence, and he had 26, 27 top Navy lieutenants who were essentially U.S. Navy spies.
Mm-hmm.
And these fellows had been in Germany on a continuous basis, except when they came back to report, since 1941.
That's amazing when you think about it, Bill, excuse me, that we were able to infiltrate the Third Reich at very high levels of advanced technology and in alleged interaction with certainly inter-solar system or intergalactic intelligent life forms. Very interesting. We got people in there. And Bill Tompkins, as you heard in our earlier programs, sat in on debriefing of these people when they'd be rotated out of Germany and then sent back. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, that's right, Jeff. To sort of set the way this thing works, I'd go back to the barracks and go to bed, nobody would bother me till around 12 o'clock. And the admiral's aide would wake me up, and I already had my uniform and everything ready, because I never knew when they were going to do this.
Uh-huh.
And he escorted me over to the admiral's tower, which is over on North Island. And actually, you can see the tower. It's still there. If you look at any one of the aircraft carriers that are tied up over there at North Island,
uh-huh,
it'll be sticking up above the flight deck. Anyway, there's a secret room in the upper level of that. And we would, animal's aide said, he's here. No other words. Okay? And he escorts me over there. We go inside, up the elevators, and into this room. And sitting next to where I was going to sit was Admiral Riccobata, the commander. And on the other side would be one of the three captains that I also had bosses for. It was crazy. And incidentally, I had just come out of boot camp, and I'm a third-class seaman. Okay?
Yeah.
And so across the table would be sitting the secretary on one side and then one of the Navy spies sitting there and nervous as you can't believe. And we would spend the next 3 to 4 hours with him defining a anti-gravitational test facility with the structures in Germany. And all the timing of setting the UFO into the center of this big concrete circular test facility, and then the starting of the tests on it, and it lifting up off the ground, and then the different maneuvers taking place, just like a test facility that we would have of a new aircraft.
Now, this is you're talking about, I believe, what they call the bell, the Glocka, the bell. It was in a round concrete structure that was basically pillars and beams of concrete, and it would be suspended in the middle. I've seen pictures of this, and I guess that's what you're talking about.
Yes, Jeff, and I know this is hard to believe because nobody would build an airplane or a vehicle out of concrete, but yes, they did. And it was an extremely successful system. But the point here is that these intelligent officers documented everything that they saw all over Germany and the occupied areas. They got into underground production facilities building UFOs, seven, eight different classified, different mission-type UFOs. Now, it was because there was an agreement between Hitler and the reptilians, and I didn't say nobody's believing this, but this is fact. This is what took place.
Well, they're listening. That's fine. As long as they listen, it doesn't matter what they do with it. I just want them to hear this, so go ahead. That's good.
So this agreement was made not with a document, but it was made telepathically between the reptilians, Hitler, and the top SS people. And the exact agreement then was many years later sort of documented to actually who gets what for what the other guy produces. But essentially, the reptilian extraterrestrials gave Hitler and the SS all of these fantastic, extremely advanced methods of propulsion, of communication, of medical advantages, of extended life, things that you would never even consider this being given. And, of course, the agreement on the reptilian side was that eventually Germany would develop naval spacecraft battle groups like the reptilians have, and up out in the galaxy with them attacking other planets and setting them up and doing what they have been doing.
So that was the trade, as you were told. The trade was that the Germans were to win the war, work with the reptilians as part of their force, as it were, out in space.
Yes.
Now, is this, can we call this within our solar system, or is this extrasolar? Is this outside of our solar system in the Milky Way galaxy? How far did it extend? What was your understanding of that?
Well, it was essentially close to 40-50% into the center of the galaxy. And, of course, again, it's hard to accept, but the understanding that was presented to us by the U.S. Navy spies was that these large spacecraft carrier battle group systems would be operating throughout the reptilians-controlled stars. And the reptilians had somehow gotten some sort of a okay that they could conquest, develop the capability to take over other stars, planets, and manage them.
So they were expanding their, they were an imperial race, they are an imperial race, and they were expanding, and they wanted, apparently, Germany to join them in this venture. Now, the obvious question that comes to mind immediately is that there are a number of reports that the Germans did, in fact, at the end of the war, have atomic weapons, and they were deployed but not used because the retribution would have been to annihilate Europe. It's just like why no one used chemical and biological weapons during the war, because the German people would have been wiped out. Germany is smaller than the state of Texas, or about the same size. It's not huge. So go ahead with that. And the question I would ask you is, why would the reptilians permit the Germans to lose the war if they were that heavily invested in them?
That's a very good question, Jeff. There's a lot of different versions of this. There's a whole lot of different approaches. and some of them are extremely complicated. Now, in 1937 and 38, the reptilians brought Germany into Antarctica, and the reptilians had two large caverns down there, and they gave Germany three smaller caverns. And there's a misinterpretation on when it was that Germany decided to take all of their production facilities for UFOs, for all of the weapons, exotic. And the number that we got from, remember, we're getting this information from people who spend 3 to 12 months in Germany collecting their data and coming back. So they get put different versions when they go back again.
Right.
But the approach was that Germany, not because they would lose the war, but because they wanted to set up major operations for large battle groups, which would be German Navy battle groups, to be built in Antarctica and operate from there as their military base here.
Okay.
So then the war didn't go the way that they wanted it to go, and so they simply increased the speed and the time to remove almost 7 million people, both military and slave workers, and took them to Antarctica and set up all these production facilities, all the research, all the continuous construction of different types of UFOs, even cigars.
Since cigar-shaped, 7 million people. How did they go back and forth between Germany and Antarctica? What is your understanding?
Okay, there was two approaches. They built large transport submarines, and hundreds of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they, because a lot of the equipment was, of course, very large, too. And so they took the equipment and the personnel, and they were taking them back to where, at the end of the war, we were told that we got Von Braun and we got 160 of the top people.
Yeah.
And maybe even Russia got, instead of we got 160, they got nearly 1,000. But the point was that 90% of what it was that they had done since 1937, because they started this program in 37. And they were working, well, the SS didn't get into it till later. And in my book, we talk about the 1,443 people. Okay, and I want to touch that for a minute, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
Our spies, again, found out that in adjacent European countries to Germany and in Germany, there was one girl, a blonde, and she was telepathically told to design a large spaceship, design the propulsion for it, put her family in it, and leave the planet. Now, she was 13 years old, I believe, at that time.
But
she was 17. She had collected 1,443 people working to do the same thing, all of them having been told telepathically to design the propulsion system and design the vehicle, put their families in it, and leave the planet. Now, there were shoe salesmen doing this. There were astrophysicists doing it. There were engineers doing it. And there were farmers doing it. This is, again, this is hard to believe, but essentially...
Now, these people are sitting across, excuse me, these people are sitting across the table from you, telling you this, and these are our best spies, coming back and reporting and then being sent back to Germany in most cases to continue. No one knows how many were discovered and killed. Where was this assembling and building going on? Was it mostly in the Antarctic?
There were underground facilities in South America. And, of course, Hitler didn't die. He got in one of their, he and his girlfriend got in one of the six-engine bomber type, half-bomber, half-transport, and flew them to Argentina.
Yeah, there were only two of those made. They were huge planes. And we know the story, thanks to Harry Cooper at Shark Hunters. It's an extraordinary story. And yes, they did go there and lived out their lives in Argentina. Go ahead, please.
Well, most of it was taken to these three large caverns. Incidentally, it's interesting to me how naive I guess I was, and I guess there's a lot of people, because I didn't realize that we had large caverns all over our planet. And this all came out later on with a lot of other things that we were doing. But some of these caverns are like this, half the size of California. And they are like 4-6 miles down to even get into them. And others are actually at sea level, and the submarines simply went into the ice at sea level and went way back in 30-40 miles and opened up into the one of the caverns at sea level. And of course the extraterrestrials had showed them how to cover up the hole to go through to get there. So this was a well-engineered, well-planned program that this little blonde girl, the 13-year-old blonde, okay?
Yeah.
In about 1937-38, people that were organized, starting to organize the SS, knew and found out about this girl and the 1,400 people.
Mm-hmm.
The SS intelligence almost confiscated them, and because they had started to develop and build UFOs. This is very, very hard to believe, but they were doing this.
Right.
Obviously, they're being helped by the extraterrestrials, the whole thing, mind control. And now, remember, these are Navy lieutenant and lieutenant commanders simply reporting what they found.
Now, they must excuse me again, there's so many questions. They must have been completely fluent in German, if not of German direct ancestry, and able to pass to have worked into the position of being able to learn these things.
Yeah, many of them, it was through family. And like you said.
Yeah. There were a lot of Germans in America, a huge number of Germans. Most Americans wanted nothing to do with the war in Europe, by the way, because of our German ancestry here. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, just a sideline. Remember that the German people didn't know anything about what the SS was doing. They had no idea that all of this stuff was being built. Well, anyway, back to the little blonde. The SS took over that whole operation and then separated into two operations. One, the SS, and then they allowed, listen to this, they allowed those 1,443 people to continue developing large UFOs and cigar-shaped vehicles.
Uh-huh.
The programs went parallel. So actually, she and most of the others ended up down in Antarctica, and many of them left the planet from Antarctica and went to other stars, planets.
It sounds amazing. When you're sitting at the table and the admirals are there and the others. How many were being in the room with you, debriefed by these spies? How many others were there? You, and go ahead.
There were the admiral's aide was not in. He was not even allowed. There would be one of the three captains, one of those was naval intelligence type. The other was the chief engineer of engineering, and the other was operational. But to be one of them at least, maybe two of them, one typist, myself, and the operative. That's all we had.
That's amazing.
And then I had a group of girls in engineering who, because they were engineering, everybody was cleared. But I would put together packages. I'd take the information, and we would collectively with the three captains and with the operative would stay for from 2 weeks to even 2 months. And most of the time it would be like 4 or 5 weeks and then back they go. But we took the information, we disseminated it. I was sort of the guy that did that. And we put packages together. Now, listen to this. We put the packages together. I take the package out to the flight line to the Admiral's plane, which is a high-wing, seven-passenger, commercial-type aircraft.
Okay.
And single engine. And we would fly to Caltech, or we would fly to Lockheed, or I flew to Douglas, and we would fly to universities all across the country, and we would take this data, classify the program, and let these different organizations address that package, that part of maybe it's propulsion, maybe it's extended life.
So this was our effort to try to stay up with, at least behind, but close to, the German technology, which was being fed to them by ETs. That's what I'm hearing. So you gave it to choice selected people in engineering and the sciences. Obviously, they were able to keep secrets, or else, and they were to try to build things, I guess, that would parallel to a degree what you were being told was in fact being made in Germany and in Antarctica.
Absolutely. That's exactly what we did. Now, it was interesting too that I flew his plane with his pilot so much that he said, Bill, why don't you take it? So I would fly it, and then when he would land it, after a while he said, okay, you do the takeoff today. So I did the takeoff, and I said, you do the navigation, and you do radio contact to the station.
I have a question. Bill, I have a question. Now, you're going from San Diego, North Island, to Caltech or somewhere. These are all flights basically to Southern California. Why would they take a chance on a plane malfunctioning and having to come down somewhere when they could have taken it by armed convoy on the ground? These are very, very sensitive papers.
They are very sensitive. I had a two-lock attaché case with documents in this, and I carried it out with my flight jacket. When I sat down the plane, we took off. So this is extremely sensitive. But it was being handled in a way that there was this fellow... with seamen, I always wore work uniforms and a flight jacket. I never was in a dress uniform, even at JPL. And in the Eastern flights, the Admiral also had a Lockheed twin engine, and I did fly that part time too. But we flew that plane to Naval Development Center in War Minister, Pennsylvania. Okay?
Uh-huh.
And I have everything set up ahead of time because I've called and we've had letters back and forth. And they meet me at the airport, and I go over to their facility and I let them read the data, and then I brief them on the program.
They must have been shocked, some of them. Although I think I hear you saying this was compartmentalized and they would only get that which they were supposed
exactly.
to address. Yeah.
It was like TRW. TRW had 300 compartments, okay?
Right.
Not just in the campus, but they had them all over Southern California.
Huh.
And but going back and trying to answer your question, I'm sure that was the decision of Admiral Rick. And the fact that they didn't have a Navy captain doing this, it was handled so simply. It was unbelievable. And I had 4 years of this, 7 days a week. And I flew to almost every military base and university that's handling military contracts in the country. And
wow.
It would be, like you said, the compartment.
Uh-huh.
And so that particular university or even the naval bases would just work that particular
uh-huh.
package.
Which,
and then,
which
at,
go ahead, Bill. Go on.
Well, I was going to say, as the same or other operatives came back with information on one specific package that would be updated,
uh-huh.
we would then put an updated package together, and I would get in the Admiral's plane and fly it back with the pilot to that facility and make the changes and make the recommendations for the changes based on the original information. And at Naval Air Development Center in Warminster, I went back there 11 times with advanced data, and it's actually separated into four or five separate packages. So you have this information, and you take it to the top people in your country,
uh-huh.
and you get them to put together something that would be possible to copy and build.
A component, okay. Where did all this, I'm going to fast forward a little bit, where did all these components end up at the end of the war, and did we ever come up with anything that could fly?
Very definitely we did, and but also we acquired, of course, the three UFOs that crashed at Roswell.
Right.
But then we acquired some seven or eight more of them that we had out at Area 51.
Why were they? Why were these UFOs crashing? Were we bringing them down with electronics or shooting them down? That's a lot of lost craft, you'd think, for an advanced race to lose over a relatively short period of time.
Well, there is a system that we did use, and I'm sorry, but I can't talk about that.
Okay.
That's how we took them down.
It was said that it was, I'll just say it, and you don't have to say anything. It was said that the Roswell crashes were caused by a very advanced radar type of equipment. They were aimed at these craft and were able to bring them down. So we were back engineering what we had captured and aware of the German efforts to build their own. Okay. Very interesting.
If you could accept that Antarctica did exist, it makes it easier to understand how the SS, with this sophisticated philosophy that you can't ever win the war, and they never accepted they lost the war. And of course, in a way, they didn't lose the war.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
The Von Braun paperclip program filtered out into every one of these places, which we had brought information. So we had Germans in Lockheed, we had Germans at Northrop, and we had Germans at Boeing, every place. And they filtered into our military and into the military companies that manufacture much of the weapons.
Okay. All right. Hold on right there. I have to pause. And when we come back, we will continue, get some comments from George and Frank. And let me remind you, if you have doubts about this, go look up Operation High Jump, 1946, and ask yourself, why did the President Truman order a massive naval fleet to go to Antarctica? Read about that. It's quite interesting. Be right back. Okay, let's get right back to it. Talking to Bill Tompkins and George Filer and Frank Chillier here. George, comments on this very, very interesting story. What recall Bill has? He's amazing.
The Nazi UFOs, and well, as you know, there are a few pictures that may or may not be true, but there are indications from various intelligence reports that the Air Force and Army had that there were UFOs being built at that time. And then right at the end of the war, the Army went in there and tried to capture as many craft as possible, and they flew them and put them aboard a British carrier and were brought to the United States and eventually to Wright-Patterson. And
they had German crews fly them to the carrier?
No, actually Americans flew them. And
that would be called a quick study if they could learn to do that, unless
they
it was
got as many aircraft, advanced aircraft that the Nazis had.
Right.
Now, there were some craft on the aircraft carrier that were not designated. I saw a list of most of them, but there were aircraft that we're familiar with. But there could have been UFOs on there. Matter of fact, I was told by one librarian that there probably was some of these craft aboard there. In other words, it's likely we brought that technology back to the United States right after the war.
That would suggest, of course, a complete parallel program to what we commonly refer to it as our space program. We already had advanced flight capabilities after the war, if not during the war.
It was quite obvious that the Germans had advanced technology to ours. Now, whether it, you know, in fact was alien or not, I don't know, but we do know that they had advanced aircraft, you know, jet propelled aircraft and
rocket propelled aircraft,
rocket being built under the underground, as a matter of fact.
All underground, remarkable.
And large numbers. And the biggest problem is they didn't have the oil that they needed and they didn't have the pilots they needed.
They were making
advanced aircraft.
At the end of the war, they were making, I believe, over 4,000 fighter planes a month underground, but no pilots and no fuel.
I mean, 262s, advanced aircraft much faster than ours. Matter of fact, I know some pilots that, are engaged against them. Usually, they had a very short time in the air, and they usually caught them as they took off or landed.
It's the only time they could catch them, basically. I did talk to one B-17 pilot. He said, we were not told about the German jets. We didn't know what they were. They went past us in the blink of an eye. He said, we didn't know what the hell we were looking at. finally they were told, but in the beginning they weren't told. They apparently didn't want to make the crews feel like they were at great risk and really unable to stop these things.
Now, what I'm really saying is that this ties into some of the things that he's saying there, that there were apparently these advanced programs there.
Mm-hmm. Frank, go ahead, George, finish up.
Well, our Air Victory Museum got a ME-262, and they built 6 copies of it and put in new jet engines. You know, when I had my TV program, I used to advertise for people to buy a rebuilt ME-262. Which
you're kidding. You were selling cloned 262s. Did anybody buy any?
Interesting enough, Lockheed and the Germans, a couple of aviation companies bought them.
So these were built to scale from the plans.
Right. It wasn't from the plans. They had the actual aircrafts, and they, like,
just copied
it, remodeled it.
Huh.
As a matter of fact, the fellow that was doing it was one of the fellows that had worked on them in Germany, and he knew the plane
inside out.
And it was a matter of retooling it based on the, in other words, they took the airplane apart and then would make the part to fit it exactly.
That's
the only
amazing
thing that was really different was the engines. We used a better type engine on the aircraft.
That's fascinating. Now, Frank, I mentioned Operation High Jump, 1946, I believe, and Admiral Byrd sent down there. This is the biggest task force since World War II. It ended a year and a half earlier. It was huge, and what in the hell were they sent to Antarctica for was the question that people had. And there were whispers, of course, about Germans hiding down there. We were going to wipe them out. But something happened down there that was not good to the American fleet.
It certainly wasn't. And, Jeff, I had a quick question for Bill. During the course of the war, did the German high command ever determine that their secrets had been leaked or compromised by these operatives?
Yes, they were. And that made it very, very bad on the operatives.
What happened to them, Bill?
Well, I think that's an understatement, and they obviously were encouraged to spill the beans, and then they were probably killed.
Yeah,
and that's not nice.
No, that's war, and you're right. It's not nice. Bill, what about Operation High Jump? What was your familiarity with that? You were in the Navy. You knew. What was the rumor?
Well, actually, the war was over, supposedly, and Nimitz was the commanding admiral on that mission. Admiral Byrd was the one that was supposed to carry it out. But we got the top man, Nimitz, the top admiral on the planet, heading up this battle group. And so they go down there, and we had PBYs, PBMs, big float planes, and several hundred aircraft of different types. We had a large aircraft carrier and loaded with helicopters and aircraft. And the long range, as they went down, the long range seaplanes, the big BBMs, took the longest flights across from one side of Antarctica area. And then they had, from another side, one of the other ships brought in with the seaplane tender, and they had two planes that came in from the other side. And they started to photograph everything that they could see. And then we sent different aircraft into looking for the entrances to the German Navy's submarines.
Uh-huh.
And when we got that close, right out of the ocean, no vehicle flying in from a runway at an airport.
Uh-huh.
But there were 27 UFOs in the first group and about a half that, 15 or so in the second group. And they shot down every helicopter and airplane that we had and in less than a day and a half. It was just...
You knew this. What were your sources on this, Bill? If you can't say, that's fine. Because what you're saying makes sense with everything I've been able to pick up.
Yeah. Okay. I would rather not say because there's certain things I can't talk about.
But, that's fine.
But the position is that we have this massive, the largest naval battle group that we had in the war with the top people. We had the cream of the crop, the very best. And they were to go down there and blow up the German facilities because they knew, our intelligence, our operatives knew that these facilities existed. And not just as research and development. I mean, these were massive production facilities. Enormous.
I understand. Uh-huh. And up out of the ocean came German or reptilian? Who was flying these things? Germans?
Well there was some of them had the German cross on them, and some of them had no identification.
Well, you have a very good source on this, I can tell. This is fascinating, and it has long been talked about, and nobody understands it, really, except if you do a lot of research, you can kind of read between the lines. What else can you tell us about this?
Well, the situation was so stunning when they sank the ships. These UFOs simply fired their weapons, and they would... the ship would catch on fire, and it would sink before anybody could get a lifeboat over the side. It was unlike any other naval war battle. It was totally unlike it. It was just unreal.
To get a ship to disintegrate and sink that quickly implies very strong beam weapons of some kind. Now, what ships were lost? Obviously, there was no effort made to take the entire fleet out, or it would have probably been successful. They wanted just to be left alone, go home, stay away. So what did they sink? A couple destroyers? Do we know?
We lost destroyers. We lost 3 support ships, and we lost 20 or 30 smaller ships that were... landing type craft with a different purpose. And
so they went down there with LSTs, that kind of thing, and they were prepared to go onshore and go into these things and destroy them. That's what they must have had a lot of troops too.
Yeah, that was the mission. We had I think it was like 16,000 Marines, 1,600 Marines, and we had all types of specialists in every technical field you can come up with, hundreds of them, and everything that we did was terrible. It was just like, it was a total unrelated to normal battle. It wasn't a battle at all. It was just a very short thing that stopped every part of the mission.
Wow.
And because these great big PPMs, they're very large aircraft and twin engine, dual wings, beautiful. And these guys are flying over to look for the entrances to the mm-hmm. different areas.
Mm-hmm.
And up on the other side of the Antarctica come these UFOs, and their particle beam weapons, just there's nothing left at all. I mean, they just disintegrate.
I understand.
It's not like blowing a hole in the wing or knocking out an engine. It just removes everything. And other aircraft could see that one being shot down, and nobody had ever seen that before. Nobody. Nobody had ever seen an aircraft being taken out like
so
that.
So the carriers that were in the group had a couple of 250 or so fighter planes, reconnaissance planes, all kinds of planes, and everything that was sent up was shot down immediately.
Yes. It was almost ridiculous. And at the same time, they're sinking the ships. And they could have sunk the carrier, too, but they, like you are saying there, Jeff, they wanted to make certain that we wouldn't bother them, period.
If we had wiped out the entire fleet, there would have been another fleet twice as big sent down there, I would suggest. As a politician, you can't explain that away too easily.
I think the problem with that whole mission was that when Admiral Byrd made his reports, he only lasted a couple of months, and then he somehow passed, and
he died.
Yes, and
no coincidence there.
Okay, but we had
I said
so many
it, you
people
didn't.
Taken out. we've had so many people taken out.
So we have to pause on that note, Bill. But so many people taken out. That would probably include our first Secretary of Defense, Admiral James Forrestal, who was also murdered.
Yes,
he knew too much. Yes. And what you're suggesting without saying it, and I'm going to finish it, is that a lot of people died to keep that lid firmly in place on what happened during Operation High Jump.
Yes.
Fair statement?
Before you hit your break, just one statement.
Go ahead.
In the book, you've got to read my mission statement. You have to read my mission statement as staff to Admiral Riccobata, okay?
Okay.
Because it's written by the Secretary of the Navy, Forrestal.
It's written for Forrestal?
It's written by Forrestal. It's signed by Forrestal.
Ah, fascinating. All right. Well, James Forrestal is a great American hero, and was murdered at Bethesda. And you can look that up anytime you want on the Internet. All right, we're going to pause for a few minutes, give everybody a rest. We'll come right back. Absolutely fascinating look at Operation High Jump. Look it up. Ask yourself the obvious questions. What the hell would we be doing sending a battle fleet of that size to Antarctica when the war was over? Because the war wasn't over. We'll be right back.